Welcome, IT Changemakers, to The DEX Show with Tim Flower and Tom McGraw. Let's get into it.
Hello, Changemakers. It's your DEX Show. I'm Tom McGraw. I'm joined as ever by Tim Flower, and we are joined for the second time by one of our favorite guests. It's the return of Ravin Jesufarsan. Ravin, great to see you again, sir.
Hi, Tom.
How have you been? I often think, you know, you're our connection to the Davos crowd, to the great and good of the world. You have to come and tell us what's going on. How's your year been so far? What are they talking about?
Well, it's great to be here with both of you. It's been going well. My last book, as you've probably seen, has done relatively well. It seems to have prompted a lot of interest. Davos was really, it was nice to get back there in January from 2020. And then perhaps more recently, the World Economic Forum Growth Summit in Geneva was a really good gathering where they released their Future of Jobs report. And it was intriguing to see, particularly in this era of generative AI, you know, the impact of automation, the impact of economic uncertainty on jobs, as well as the impact of the energy transition on potentially work. So some exciting changes, I think.
Big topics there, and congratulations on the book. Last time we spoke was actually October of 2021. Doesn't time fly, gentlemen? and you spoke all about the concept that's stuck in my head ever since, which is called the democratization of work. So, you know, when we reached out to you to have you back on the show, we immediately wanted to hear what you wanted to discuss first and foremost, and you raised a concept called the skills-based enterprise and the impact of new technology on this notion. So let's start with it, because I hadn't heard of it before, as I hadn't the democratization of work once upon a time. What is the skills-based enterprise, Ravin?
Yeah, so it's probably the hottest topic around, and it does tie into that point about the democratization of work, because if you think about it, Tom and Tim, the two most important forces that are transforming work are certainly digitalization, you know, enabling technologies like the one we're on, but also, you know, the large language models, which are democratizing access to AI. You know, PwC announced that they're training all of their employees to use ChatGPT. And ChatGPT is just the tip of the iceberg on the digitalization journey, because you've also got, you know, DALL-E 2, you've got Codex, which is making English the most powerful coding language around, you know, set aside Python and Julia, etc. So digitalization certainly is one really important force. The other, Tom, to your point you made, democratization of work, and just to remind your users, you know, when we use the phrase the democratization of work, it's what it's speaking to is our growing ability to increasingly decouple work from its traditional confines of space, time, and structure. And those two forces together are transforming work and giving rise to this notion of the skills-based enterprise. And what the skills-based enterprise is it's organizations who have shifted from the job as the singular currency for work to increasingly skills being the currency for work. And the reason they're doing that is to drive much greater agility and resilience and flexibility to respond to those two forces I talked about. They're moving beyond that one-to-one relationship between a degree, a person, and a position to the many-to-many, you know, to the unique bundle of skills and capabilities, that's Tom versus Tim, the many different career opportunities that could be opened up for you, you know, when we go beyond that one-to-one relationship between a person and a position. And what it involves is the matching of changing demand for work to the skills of the talent we have, to the specific skill gaps that need to be closed, so that we can make those connections ever more seamlessly. So that's really the essence of the skills-based enterprise, if that makes sense.
And you see it as effectively something that's going to really exacerbate that democratization trend?
I think so. I think it. I don't know if it exacerbates as much as enables organizations to more effectively respond to that inexorable force that is the democratization of work. We're just going to see that continue. And I think the skills-based enterprise allows companies to respond to it proactively and perhaps even use it to for advantage.
So, you know, it doesn't matter what topic we have on the show. We always work our way back to AI. It always is. Recently, it feels like it's almost becoming too much of a cliche. Stop talking about AI. But let's talk about it in the bigger picture. So, what kind of impact do you think it has on the economy at large? And do you anticipate AI, what do you anticipate AI having in terms of an impact over, say, the next 5 years on the larger scope of the economy?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, this is one of the few instances where the hype might actually match the reality. You know, where I'm seeing in the work I'm doing with clients in some great research that Eric Brynjolfsson at Stanford is doing. And Eric's been really vocal, and I think rightly so, that the way we think about impact, largely in our rather outdated ways of counting and measuring productivity, don't really capture how AI has been democratized. You know, if you look at just even going back to, you know, Facebook and Twitter and just social media, and you know, the impact of social media on productivity is completely ignored and discounted. And I think Eric estimates that just the technologies that are freely available to all of us have probably added about a percentage point to GDP that goes unaccounted for. And I think we've got similar situation, Tim, with what we're seeing with generative AI. And particularly as we see how, you know, there's some interesting experiments emerging where, you know, you've got a control group that doesn't have generative AI and a pilot where they've used generative AI. And we're seeing in some instances 40 to 50% improvements in productivity because what we're doing is democratizing knowledge and creativity, right? And the interesting thing is this is just, you know, GPT, right, and text generation. But if you think of the broader implications of these large language models, you know, think of DALL-E 2 on image generation, Codex on coding, you know, Mega MOI BART on drug discovery, you know, the impact is just multiplying exponentially. And I think that's what's really interesting about this next generation of AI. You know, it does need its guardrails, as many have talked about. But I think it has just tremendous potential.
So I would maybe challenge a little bit on whether we're increasing knowledge. So let's talk a little bit about it, because over the years, you know, when Google came out, I heard a lot of people say, "I don't need to remember things anymore. I don't need to memorize things. I can just go do a search." And that then transitioned into, you know what, I don't even need to know things anymore. I can go ask. And I think that the ChatGPTs have a, you know, I don't need the knowledge. ChatGPT has the knowledge. I just need to know what kind of questions to ask, and I will be informed on what the answers are. So I'm curious where you see the correlation or the relationship between knowledge and skill and the implications to the enterprise, more specifically, you know, this attainment of knowledge and skill as a necessary component to get a job and employment. What do you see the correlation between knowledge and skill and the implications that AI brings to it?
Yeah, that's such a fabulous question, because, you know, I think what we've done is we've democratized knowledge, right? But what we haven't done is democratize logic and critical thinking. And I think that's absolutely essential. And Tim, and I think, you know, I'm really glad you brought this question up, because one of the issues, as we know, with these large language models is, unlike other types of machine learning, there is no logic embedded into these large language models, right? We're essentially sort of looking at basically next best guess, right? Next best, you know, word, image, graphic, where are there, you know, likely connections based on this massive volume of data. And I do think, you know, forgive me, I'm drawing a blank on the name of the poet, but there's this quote that sticks in the back of my head is a very famous English poet where he talked about, you know, in the quest for knowledge, what wisdom have we lost? In the quest for information, what knowledge have we lost? In the quest for data, you know, what real information have we lost? It'll come to me, I'm sure, probably after the show.
We'll put it in the show notes. Yes,
excellent.
T.S. Eliot.
T.S. Eliot, thank you. Oh, yes, it was T.S. Eliot.
And ironically enough, I Googled it, you know?
I was going to say, did you remember that?
But actually, you know, and in general, I have to say, you know, talking about the question of hype and AI, I have never in my life been sort of slightly nauseated and impressed by first using a technology as I was first using ChatGPT and first experimenting with it. And I kept giving it more and more complex instructions. And it's that moment when if it took 5 minutes, I feel like the impact would be different. If it took, you know, like, it would just feel like, it's gone in there, it's figuring it out.
Right.
But it's the immediacy, isn't it?
Exactly.
And it's the immediacy of talking to somebody.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, individuals don't have that wealth of information to access on a dime like that. But they are able to filter information in an immediate way and respond to you. And we think of that as consciousness, and we're not at all used to encountering that same immediacy in an external, seemingly non-conscious entity. I find it quite remarkable, and instantly it's changed the way I work and other people I work with as well. So
yeah,
the sense that it's going to have a big impact is undeniable. So I want to pick up again actually on all of these trends, Ravin, in fact, starting with the democratization of work, and what they seem to add up to for the worker, for the employee, as we say, is a portrait of a future or imminent professional space which is very, very impersonal. Arguably, you know, the sentiment that has traditionally kind of bound us to teams and colleagues, to organizations, which more recently we kind of formalize as culture, office culture. I mean, that would seem to be, if we look at how these trends are developing and where they're going, a fast-growing atavism, you know, something that's just completely outmoded in the modern working world. Does that, you know, first of all, I suppose the question is to what extent is that a viable trend for us as emotional, sentimental beings? And second, I guess first of all, the question is that accurate? Second of all, is that a good thing? Is that a viable thing? And third of all, is there anything that can rub against it, you know?
Yeah, that's a really good, really good question, Tom. You know, I do think as we introduce these technologies, they are fundamentally altering culture, right? Because if you think of our traditional cultural artifacts, and I'll even go back to, you know, forget the technology, but, you know, to quote another sort of futurist, Alvin Toffler, you know, in 1970 said, we would all be living in electronic cottages. And in the United States from 1970 to 2020, we got to a whopping 50%. Sorry, we got to a whopping 6% of all work being done full-time remote. And overnight, we got to 56%, right, in May of 2020. But to me, the thing that, you know, this starts with, again, going back to the democratization of work and the decoupling, if you will, from the artifacts that have traditionally shaped culture and work culture. You know, the office was probably the most defining, most visible feature of that culture, right? Because we all came to the office between 9 to 5. We hang out at the water cooler, and Tim and I would talk about our kids or, you know, football games, etc. So that culture started and ended from between 9 to 5, and it existed within the walls of the enterprise. And then we just, you know, open it up, right? So it now permeates, so work permeates every facet of life. I do think we are going to start to see, we are starting to see a reordering and a new set of artifacts come about and redefining what that culture looks like. You know, that I mentioned PwC is training all of their employees on ChatGPT. Soon, ChatGPT in that organization will become a critical part of their culture because it'll be part of the shared set of experiences of everyone who is a part of that enterprise. But I do think we need to be incredibly intentional, because, you know, we as a species sort of cling on to those experiences, right, to define what binds us together. You know, in the part, you know, when it was the office, we were forced together by the space. Now, what are the new artifacts, right? Those shared experiences, those common connections to mission and purpose, which is another reason why you see more and more companies indexing to mission and purpose, because they know that that's what connects, you know, these disparate interests who may not bump into each other very often, if at all, you know, to a common mission and purpose, to a single culture.
And what about, if I can just insert a question here, I assume you're optimistic, Ravin, about how our economies globally and nationally adapt to this new technology and the opportunities that are at present very unforeseeable that arise from it. Is that accurate? And can you be any more concrete about your cause for medium-term optimism? Because in general, I think the discourse around AI is a pessimistic one.
Yes.
And the sense of an old world making way for a new one makes people feel very anxious and unsteady, reasonably enough. And I was wondering what your take on that overall is.
Yeah, you know, I would say I'm cautiously optimistic.
Okay. Even your course, now I'm worried, Robin.
I see the opportunity, you know, I see the prize ahead of us, Tom. But I worry about, you know, our propensity to sacrifice long-term sustainability for short-term profit and gain. And, you know, I've seen just in the work I do with organizations, some not so intelligent decisions around, you know, just on a micro level, right? This is incredibly micro, you know, smaller firms rushing to sort of replace their interns, replace 70 to 80% of the work of their junior level talent with GPT, you know, with GPT, right? Particularly on the advertising, right. The legal side of things. And yes, you know, yeah, it's going to save you a little bit of money in the near term. You can never replace an entire job, as we know, with particularly with a single technology. But the longer term consequence is, you know, who's going to be your manager or supervisor next year? Who's going to be the leader of the firm the year after? Because, and it goes back to something Tim said, right? That question, which again, I loved, it's not just knowledge and information. What you're building in most of our businesses with these apprenticeship models is logic and discernment and critical thinking. And that to me is just where, you know, one small example of where, you know, we sacrifice the long term for the near term benefit.
Yeah, and I suppose there's another dynamic a friend of mine pointed out to me, which is, you know, capitalism depends on having people to sell its products,
right?
Like if capitalism would really kind of commit a kind of economic suicide if it kind of excavated its own workforce for technology, because who then is the market? But maybe this points. I mean, I'm interested in your reflections upon that potential trend. Medium term, Ravin, and whether that actually just points towards universal basic income and systems like right. that, or we actually see, or you actually anticipate capitalism to have some enduring creative vitality and with it the creation of new opportunities and economies.
So my personal sense is, you know, and I actually wrote a paper on this and laid out the two sort of ends of the continuum that you've just alluded to, one where we sort of are in a post-consumer society where we need some form of, you know, universal basic income to sustain that, you know, that notion of consumerism, or do we actually end up in an era where there is sufficient opportunity created for us to keep upskilling and reskilling, to keep moving humanity up that knowledge, you know, knowledge curve, if you will, as we substitute, you know, more and more of the things we've traditionally done. And I'm optimistic on that front, Tom and Tim, that we will, in fact, there is, in fact, emerging opportunity. What I'm perhaps uncertain about is are two things. One is, will we afford ourselves the time to upskill and reskill. And it's that pace of change that I worry about, because we all know that that pace has increased exponentially over the course of the last 100 years. And, you know, are we approaching the point where we just can't adjust fast enough? Not sure, you know, question. And that's one worry. The other is, I don't think we will completely sort of, you know, do away with automation doing everything in every single industry. But I do think that certain industries are going to go through significant change. And enabling, to my first point about time, enabling those transitions for people from the industries that are heavily affected into the emerging industries, which may be quite different, I think is going to be really important.
Yeah, I really like I like that concept of advancing the human race to upskill everybody, right? And we as a human race are now advancing ourselves, and this gives us the ability. So I think there's going to be a hybrid of some of the notions you talked about. One is that upskilling of humanity and society, but also making sure that those that don't have access to either the technology or the corporations don't get left behind, because there's already a gap of people being left behind, right? So I think we've got to have a bit of both worlds, yeah, in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Robin, kind of the wrap up question. We started our conversation, or we, you know, early on we talked about the economic impacts, and we talked about the implications to employers and business in general, down to the individuals. Being a technologist myself, what should technologists be focusing on today to stay ahead of these trends and the tendencies pushed forward by AI? Where should folks be focusing on if you're technology minded, other than just learning how to use ChatGPT?
Right. Yeah, you know, really, really good question there. You know, I think, Tim, there's two things I would say. One is, all of us, technologists or otherwise, need to have this mindset of just perpetual reinvention. And I think that's what's going to stand us in good stead as, you know, the next generation of AI emerges, as other technologies emerge, right? So how do we keep reinventing ourselves? Do we, you know, are we curious enough? Do we give ourselves the space to learn and develop, you know, in the flow of work? I say to all of my clients, we've got to get out of these inane conversations about work-life balance, because we've lost that war. We instead actually need to be much more intentional about designing in space for each of us individually and collectively, so that we have the space for both learning as well as well-being in the flow of work. And so I think that notion of space for reinvention is important. I think more tactically, Tim, you know, we've talked for a long time about leaders who are T-shaped, right, or pie-shaped, people who, you know, are deep in one area and then maybe see connections broadly. I think that's still important. But I was introduced to a concept by a colleague of mine around this notion of the V-shaped learner. And that's the learner who may start off in a narrow domain, but she's able to sort of build out at the margins into adjacent domains. And I think that's going to be equally important. I don't think it's one or the other. But I think the talent who can sort of build deep technical capability in adjacent areas is going to be increasingly critical as well.
Good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to put in a final curveball for you, Ravin. Oh, it's not a curveball at all. You're going to be all over this one. But you mentioned at the top of the discussion, being at the WEF, talking about sustainability, and And I'm fascinated to hear how that enters this confluence of new technologies and trends, and how you see that as a catalyst for further change, and what that change looks like when you add this environmental factor to the overall picture.
Yeah, that is a good question, Tom. I think, you know, when I think of sustainability and the technological implications, I think two thoughts sort of come about. You know, something Tim said a second ago, and I sort of traced this back over the last four industrial revolutions. The second industrial revolution, we actually reduce inequality dramatically, right? Because there was lots of inequality. You had highly skilled artisans, and then everyone else who was, you know, tending to pigs and things like that. And as we introduced automation, we brought more people into the game. You know, you could go work at a factory and earn a lot more than you might on the farm, etc. And then in subsequent iterations, we actually drove more inequality because we increased the premiums on people who were intelligent, people who had access to technology. And I think what we're seeing with this next generation of generative AI, again, this is where I'm really optimistic, is the potential for that democratization of access to bring more people into the game. You know, you don't need to have spent 30 years in graphic design to be able to create something that someone who's maybe got 5 years of that logic, Tim, that critical thinking, might be able to create with DALL-E 2. So I think that's, to me, one dimension of where that sustainability perhaps gets re-injected into society, Tom, because I think the path we were on was not a sustainable one. You know, we were on that growing inequality, you know, as we all know, was not sustainable and was going to lead to, it's the stuff that makes for revolutions, right? As we've seen many times over history. But this is where, not to put everything on ChatGPT and suggest that it's going to be the salvation of the species, but I do think in some instances it can help us. I think that's one piece. I think the other is going to be how we handle the transition to net zero. And I am truly optimistic that some of these technologies are going to be helpful in creating that next generation of technology solutions, that next generation of skills that are going to require power technologies like carbon capture, sequestration, etc., which I think are going to be increasingly important to undo the damage that we've already done. So, you know, a couple of perspectives, different, you know, angles on sustainability, if helpful.
Very helpful. And just a fantastic chat, Ravin, and wonderful to have you back on the show. Before you go, please tell the listeners about your brilliant new book and where they can find it and where they can find you.
Yeah, absolutely. So the last book that came out was called Work Without Jobs. It's my fourth. You can get there is a website, www.workwithoutjobs.com, and my website is ravinjsutharsan.com, and I would love to have everyone follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn.
Absolutely fantastic. Ravin, thanks so much for coming back on the Deck Show. Hope to see you again.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Ravin.
To make sure that you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure to leave a rating of the show. Just tap the number of stars you think the podcast deserves. If you'd like to learn more about how NextThink can help you improve your digital employee experience, head over to nextthink.com. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.